From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Keeping trees in your yard could actually protect your home rather than threaten it during tropical storms and hurricanes. That goes against much of the conventional wisdom in the region about trees on one's property during hurricane season. Today, we'll find out why. Tree canopies also tend to improve property values. That's according to multiple studies, including a 2016 meta-analysis by the U.S. Forest Service. That study shows that to maximize property values, homeowners prefer about 30% tree coverage on or near a property, but it also shows people value tree canopies in the county in which they live, green spaces, at a coverage rate of 38%, more than on their own property. Researchers say people might prefer more trees where they work, shop, and recreate, because it's the homeowner that generally pays maintenance costs and bears risks such as storm damage and wildfires. Today, we'll look at ways the Cape Fear region can maintain and improve its tree canopies. We'll also find out why nourishing soil can reduce the need for synthetic pesticides. Joining me now is the new director for North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. Lloyd Singleton, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're inviting you to join the conversation during this live Wednesday discussion. The phones are, of course, in service of the pledge drive today, but you can send emails, questions we're looking for, to coastline@whqr.org. Lloyd Singleton, there are so many interesting twists that led to your arrival in the Cape Fear region, but you did land here 10 days before Hurricane Florence hit. When you got here, were there issues that you observed in the region that made you think, oh boy, we're not ready for a hurricane?
There were. I feel like we have two major problems to address. And being part of Cooperative Extension, we're in education outreach, and I think we have that mission. The areas would be water, and that's sometimes too little, but often too much. And how can we help get it diverted to the right areas? And then also trees. I see a lot of tree canopy. I see a lot of trees that are not maintained properly. Then I also see a lot of trees that are removed that maybe shouldn't be.
Well, let's talk about this notion that trees could protect your property rather than threaten it. And I'm thinking of private property now during a storm, because this does kind of fly in the face of what a lot of people just, you know, say in casual conversation. How can they protect your property? Don't you want to get all the trees away from your home?
Yeah, absolutely not. That would be conventional wisdom, but it's not the case, because a properly maintained tree of the right species for that space can actually help to divert the winds and probably create less damage for your home or the roof in particular. If you have no tree coverage around a home, it's very possible that the uplift winds could peel the roof back versus a errant branch maybe falling and hitting a rooftop or something. We do have some problem species of trees too, and those do need to be removed or at least avoided in the area, but many good mature trees will actually protect the homes.
What are the problem species?
Well, Bradford pear is the biggest one that comes to mind. And basically the branching of the tree is just very weakly attached, and they're going to be a problem. They're also very short-lived, and a Bradford pear needs to be removed. We have plenty of alternatives.
How did Bradford pears get to be so popular?
Well, it's good marketing, and they were bred to be a species that was thought to be sterile, but they're really not. They end up crossbreeding and creating nuisance species in the wild. So they're beautiful, I mean, as far as the bloom, but it doesn't smell good. And I think their time has been served.
Yeah, they're stinky. One of our graduate fellows was talking about St. Louis and how that urban landscape had been peppered with Bradford pears for that very reason. They're beautiful when they bloom. Mm-hmm. But there's the stench from mm-hmm. the blossoms, and there's also seed pods that drop all kinds of inky colored stuff. And,
yeah.
And so you're saying they're also dangerous. They're not really sturdy trees.
That's correct.
What are, for a individual homeowner, what are the principles that people generally don't pay attention to that would create a well-maintained tree? What do we need to know about the tree in our front yard that's close to our house?
Okay, well, as trees mature, they need attention. I like to equate that with going to have your teeth cleaned or checked up. If you have a mature tree on your landscape, you need to have someone that's an expert evaluate that tree every few years. You want to look for any diseased branches, any potential rot, but also you can avert some of the problems by doing proper structural pruning, keeping the tree to the right size for the space, and then just having a professional look at it every couple of years is a very good idea to make sure you've got the great maturity going on there.
What would you consider a mature tree?
Anything 25 years old or older.
And how close to the structure could a good-sized tree be and still, you know, be a safe?
15 feet away from a foundation would be an important factor, but that would be for a smaller tree. For instance, if you want a live oak, I wouldn't go any closer than 30 feet to the house.
Now, speaking about live oaks, there are some beautiful specimens that kind of cover Market Street. You know, there's this tree canopy over part of Market Street leading into downtown Wilmington. And there's been some controversy. We've heard from some city officials that once they reach a certain level of maturity, once they reach a certain age, they're not really safe and need to come down. And then we've heard other people say, why are you taking down our beautiful live oaks? So can you weigh in on that? What do we need to understand
about that? Well, in an urban environment, when you have a lot of impervious surface at the roots under the tree, it's not going to thrive like it would in the wild. For instance, a live oak in a forest could easily live to be 300 years old and be very healthy and not problematic. But when you have the air pollution, when you have a lack of rainfall getting to the root zone, when you have highly compacted soils from traffic, construction, then the life of that tree may easily be shortened and it may actually be the best choice to take it down.
Are there other kinds of trees that could live longer than a live oak in an urban setting like that when their roots are so covered with impervious surfaces?
There are. We actually need more research on that. And then there are also things that you can do in the installation phase that make it more appropriate for the tree. One thing we can do is a lot less impervious surfaces. If we do other kinds of street coverings that allow rainfall to soak in, it's a really good idea.
What kinds of street coverings could you have in an urban setting that would be more pervious?
Let's go back to brick or cobblestone. And then also there's a pervious concrete product that's used quite a lot now. Coastal Federation has done several grant projects showing that you can have a very functional parking lot that is a pervious surface with concrete. It kind of looks like popcorn.
Wow. So you've said that developers who are building new neighborhoods don't necessarily have to clear cut. And, you know, we see this going on all over the place. We've seen it within city limits in Wilmington. I'm thinking of The Point, which is a relatively new development near the Cameron Art Museum, kind of in Midtown. You know, that used to be a forested area, and it's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's now, you know, residential and commercial space. And then in Brunswick County, of course, we see it. There are developers that just clear cut acres, take out every last stick before they start installing infrastructure. How can you keep trees when you need to put in sewer mains or other forms of infrastructure for new homes?
Well, I think it takes very good planning, and it may actually be a little bit more costly for the developer in the short run. But I do believe the value added to that community for the long term would provide a good cost benefit for that. If you plan to have zones of trees that you can leave untouched, that's always good for habitat, for wildlife, etc.
You're listening to Coastline. So explain to us how that might work. Let's say the developer is willing to spend a little bit more and have some clumps of trees. How would you go about designing such a...
Well, I think you want to start with the tree inventory and look what trees are there and what areas really are worth salvaging, setting aside, and then kind of designing your plan around the trees instead of just thinking of a blank slate. I just think the trees need that voice. They need to be recognized as having value, and then let's find a way to save some of them and work around that.
Well, let's talk about the value of tree canopies since it costs more to do that. You know, this Forest Service study that I cited in the introduction talked about how tree canopies improve property values, and it was referring to both tree canopies that are on private property and tree canopies that are part of a county in which someone lives. What kinds of benefits can you say, other than increasing property values? Why do property values increase when you have more trees? What is it about them?
Well, people are actually happier. It's very good for that human health and well-being aspect. When I was the landscape manager at the theme park, we even evaluated the sales at some of those little stands that sell the trinkets or the ice cream cones. And the ones that were in a shady area had sales that were at least double those that were out in the full sun. So people are generally drawn to areas that do have some natural tree canopy.
So you can get some relief from a heat wave.
Correct.
So there's also mitigation of heat islands, right?
Absolutely. They definitely do bring down the temperature. And with a facing an increase in our overall temperature, we're going to look very strongly to that. Trees also will sequester carbon, which is a good thing. And they also do help to clean water. I mean, we all want clean drinking water, and so the more trees that are there to help serve as a filter is a good thing.
How does that work? How do they filter the water?
Well, as the trees take water up, of course, any impurities are going to be captured by the biomass of the tree, and then as the tree transpires, releases, evaporates water, that will be clean.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Lloyd Singleton, who is the new director for North Carolina Cooperative Extension New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. When we come back from this break, we'll take some listener questions. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of good tree maintenance principles, as well as creating landscapes that nourish the ecosystem rather than deplete it. Lloyd Singleton joined the North Carolina Cooperative Extension New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum just before Hurricane Florence hit the region in September of last year. He's with us now and answering your questions on this Wednesday. The phone lines are in service of the last day of the pledge drive, yay. But you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Lloyd Singleton, we've been talking about why tree canopies increase property values, both on private property and then on public property. And you've talked about how they help to clean the water. They make people happier because they give people a place to go in the blazing hot sun, get some relief. They mitigate heat islands. What are some of the other reasons that tree canopies actually create value in a community?
Well, let's talk about wildlife. I mean, who was here before humans were? There's a lot of animals that we need to provide habitat for.
Fox squirrels.
Sure, and birds.
Venus flytraps. Yeah. Oh,
we need to do a lot to actually protect the wildlife because they honestly need our help because we've done so much change to the face of our community that we really need, we have a responsibility, I feel, to provide habitat for that. The other idea is to have wildlife corridors where you try to manage your stands of trees such that they blend together and then your wildlife can move around. They don't all necessarily stay in one block. So a lot of it comes back to planning. Really good planning for urban development is important.
I mentioned the point before, that's, you know, one of the newer developments in Wilmington that has restaurants, a movie theater, places to live. And that area that was forested used to be pretty widely recognized as one of the more biodiverse sections of Wilmington before all the trees came out and fox squirrels frolicked there. Is there any way that with some new policies you could ever bring back any of that biodiversity, or is it just gone now?
No, I think you can definitely recreate habitats to encourage that. It's a political thing, though, and it needs to be addressed from development regulations, for instance, to at least prevent less habitat destruction without, you know, planning for some mitigation on that.
Hap, one of our listeners, wrote in, and he says, please enlighten listeners and homeowners. Thank you for this, Hap. And I know Tom with the Transplanted Garden will be happy about this, too. Please enlighten listeners and homeowners on proper trimming or pruning of crepe myrtles. Improper and severe pruning is sometimes referred to as crepe murder. Yes, it is. I believe this weakens them in the long run. They don't maintain their beautiful shape. So, yes, Tom from the Transplanted Garden, which is one of the local nurseries and plant sellers around here, he's very knowledgeable, talks about crepe murder. So what is it, and how do we stop it?
Well, crepe murder is when you prune branches back to kind of a 2 or 3 inch thick wood. It's simply inappropriate. Crepe myrtles don't actually need to be pruned at all. If you do remove any branches of crepe myrtle, it needs to be any dead or diseased branching or crossing branches. You can even remove the spent blooms if you want, but if not, they become bird food. And I think there's a thought that the crepe myrtle that is pruned severely will bloom more.
Yes.
And that's scientifically been proven to be untrue.
It's just incorrect.
It's incorrect. The number of bloom and the bloom season will actually be longer and bigger if you do not prune your crepe myrtles.
So that's something leading into mistakes that professional landscapers unwittingly make. That's one of them, and it's something that we've talked about on Coastline before. But what are some other kind of common landscaping mistakes that get made around this region?
Well, I think one of the things that we have fallen into is doing things with pesticides preventatively. In other words, you don't want to have any chance to have an aphid, so therefore you're going to do some sort of systemic insecticide in early spring. Well, that systemic insecticide may go up into the plant and then exhibit itself in the bloom. And then you would have bees visit that, and then they would be declining because they're actually taking in an insecticide. So instead of doing anything that's synthetic on a proactive basis, let's wait and treat it when it's a problem. For instance, ladybugs need to eat aphids. So perhaps we need to tolerate aphids on a plant for a little while and see if they don't become ladybug food. It's just a different way of thinking.
What do aphids do to a plant? Why are people kind of...
They're piercing, sucking insects, and they take some of the juices out of the plant. And there can be infestations that are really severe and could damage the plant permanently. However, often they're not severe, and they just do a little bit of aesthetic damage. There it comes back to, what's our sense of aesthetic? Why are we intolerant of a few spots on a leaf? Brown is a color, too, and deserves equal opportunity. So I think we need to kind of shift our paradigm on what's expected. It's kind of a modern concept that we need to have a perfect landscape. And nature seeks balance, not perfection.
And along those lines, last week we talked about creating landscapes that are conducive to pollinators, especially honeybees. And one of the points made during that discussion is that monocultures of sod, grass, have become anathema to the health of the pollinator population. That is this kind of reigning aesthetic that continues as we see the explosion of development. It's just what gets installed. So what would you suggest for these suburban developments that want to have beautiful lawns?
Well, I believe we do need more research on this, because we want our industries to be able to make money doing things and creating landscape environments that are pleasing to people. But I do believe that there's an opportunity for blends of ground covers that could serve for yards instead of monocultures of turf. I think turf grass can be part of it, but these blends could be turf grasses and legumes, for instance, which would fix nitrogen from the air, provide that nutrient that the plants need. I'll tell you that at the Arboretum, we're going to try something this spring. We're going to try a mix of a microclover and a Argentine bahia grass. Not a lot of research to know whether this is going to do well in the area, but my instinct and experience leads me to believe I think it will, and it will be a great pollinator provider ground cover that then just needs to be mowed, but it does not need to have any synthetic fertilizers applied.
How close will it look to what we think of as a traditional lawn?
It's going to be green, and you'll be able to keep it mowed to a common height. But otherwise, it's going to have round leaves and strap leaves mixed together. But again, I think we can change our desired aesthetic a little bit and recognize that to give value to the pollinators and the other wildlife, we can tolerate something that's a little bit different and still consider it beautiful.
And why do we care about pollinators in a suburban setting when we're not growing food crops?
Well, we're not the only ones that eat food, and we are really interrupting the entire ecosystem if we're, not allowing insects to live, because they're a huge food source for lots of other wildlife.
Such as?
Well, birds, for instance.
Right.
People do love birds, so I don't have to talk about rats, because people don't like rats, but
Some people don't.
Right, okay. But I think the whole idea, if you're disrupting an ecosystem cycle, there's going to be consequences, and we don't know for sure what all would happen, but we do know that insect populations are on the decline, and we will ultimately have to make some changes to correct that.
We have an email from Dr. Thaddeus Coyne, who says, "We've lived here 30 years now and know all too well the dangers of trees, particularly tall pines during hurricanes. He says, we built our small office in 2012. The city refused our request to remove dangerous pines. Hurricane Florence brought down a large pine spear that stuck in the ground 15 feet behind our building. If 15 feet forward, my building and my practice might have been destroyed. There are many stories of deadly tree falls, including the deaths that made the national news. Our city needs to quit hugging dangerous trees. Property owners need the right to remove dangerous trees." What would you say to Dr. Coyne?
Well, I agree with that. And I think each tree needs to be evaluated on its own merits as far as, is that the proper species and has it been maintained properly? And there are trees that are better to have in the proximity of buildings. So I think instead of having a blanket policy of no tree removal, it needs to be on a case-by-case basis, such as your live oaks on Market Street.
And so is this, he's calling them dangerous pines. Are pines generally not good trees to have around your home?
There's a lot of different species of pines, and I would say that a loblolly is going to be much more susceptible to wind damage than, for instance, a longleaf. So it's going to depend on the type of pine and how well-maintained it is, how healthy it is.
And longleaf pines are much less common here than they once were.
Correct. That was the primary species, I believe, for this area prior to our influence.
And so are they difficult to grow? I think there's been a recognition that bringing back the longleaf pine would also nourish the ecosystem here in so many other ways.
They're slower to grow, and so consequently there's not as much, you don't get as much bang for the buck when you go to buy one at a nursery. They're going to be more expensive because the nurseryman has had to grow them longer, but sometimes buying something that's more expensive that's better is a good long-term option.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of good tree management practices, sustainable ornamental landscaping, and dealing with issues familiar to the Cape Fear region. We're going to get to stormwater runoff and storm damage. Answering your questions on this Wednesday, Lloyd Singleton, he's the director of North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. The phones are, of course, in service of the pledge drive on this Wednesday, but you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. Talk to us, Lloyd Singleton, about this idea of nourishing the soil and how that could reduce the need for synthetic pesticides. What's the link there?
Microbes. So it's the microbial activity in soil that actually makes plant nutrients available to the plant. It's not simply a factor of putting a fertilizer on the ground and the plant taking it up. It's an entire system that will actually help to nourish the plant. And I guess my philosophy is if you keep the soil healthier, your plant is going to be healthier. And healthy plants are the ones that are able to resist the attacks of pests, be it an insect or a disease. Just as in our bodies get weak when we're stressed, we're going to be more likely to get sick. Well, same thing with the plant. If you keep the environment more healthy, I'm a huge proponent of amending soil with good microbially active compost, because a lot of times the things that we've done to our soil, for instance, the application of synthetic products, have killed some of that microbial activity. There's millions of microbes in a handful of soil, and some of them can't survive some of the things we do to them, and so it's a good idea to put it back. I like to give the analogy of if we take antibiotics. I think sometimes we're supposed to eat yogurt afterwards to put good microbiome back in our gut. Well, same idea. You can introduce some good microbiology back into the soils to have healthier plants.
So you would get that from compostable material?
Correct. Now, it needs to be a high-quality finished compost. And what I mean finished is that it's done decomposing. If it doesn't, if you apply a compost that isn't finished decomposing, it will actually take nitrogen away from the plant to use in its own decomposition process. So it's very important to know the source of your compost and know that it's a good quality one. You can often tell by the smell. If it smells like earth, that's a good thing.
And what are some other smells that would tell us things?
If it smells nasty or putrid, you don't want to use that yet. It needs to be cooked some more. It needs to be finished, as in turned over and whatever. The other key is, can you recognize what that compost came from? If you could, it's not finished yet. It's not done. It needs to just look like good, rich soil.
So if somebody wanted to begin composting in their own backyard, do you have suggestions for that? I mean, I think there are other places you can get compost,
yes,
such as New Hanover County's Environmental Management Department. They've got a giant composter.
Right.
But if somebody wanted to do it individually, what basic best practices?
There are a lot of different options, and I'd actually refer folks to our plant clinic staffed by Master Gardeners. They can give plenty of handouts that give different options for doing composting at home.
You're listening to Coastline. And so you want to amend the soil, feed it with compost that is done cooking, mm-hmm, and has high microbial content.
Mm-hmm.
What are some plants that would be really good for this region in general to install? And I guess the flip side of that question is, are there certain plants that you've seen as part of the landscaping aesthetic here that really don't belong here and aren't helping anybody?
Well, I think the monocultures of turf need to be reevaluated for sure. I think a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to keep that grass free of any weeds and green and healthy, and it's really a lot of effort. There may be other alternatives. I think there are a lot of native plant species that are underutilized in a landscape, and I think some of that stems from the idea that native plants have to look wild and woolly, and that's not really true. They can actually be part of a bona fide landscape plan. They can meet HOA requirements, but they can still provide the function of an ecosystem and habitat for wildlife. Number of different tree species that I think could be used more. I'm a huge fan of redbud and a number of the cultivars of redbud that have been developed. They are a great small tree, and I think a lot of our homes are surrounded by really large trees, which isn't necessarily appropriate for the design as well as the potential wind hazard. So we want to maybe have smaller trees in the landscape, and it doesn't have to be a crepe myrtle. We have native species that would be a good substitute.
What are some other good plants for people to consider installing?
Wow, the list is so huge. there's some really beautiful native grasses that I think look good in clumps. Dwarf or muley grass is a really pretty one. We also would recommend some of the hollies. There are native hollies. Ilex vomitoria, for instance, has both a tree form as well as a shrub form, would be good. There's so many, and encourage people to visit the Arboretum, and our plants are well labeled, and we can show you around and help you pick out some good plants for your landscape.
Well, speaking of the Arboretum, you told a story about arriving here, finding out that near the Arboretum, you were unwittingly flooding a neighbor's property because some water was being diverted into a garden that couldn't hold all of the water. Can you tell us about that circumstance and what you did to fix the problem?
Absolutely. Well, we partner with New Hanover County's Parks and Gardens. They're the maintenance staff now for the Arboretum and have done a tremendous job. The situation was that all of the stormwater from our roofline and our parking lot had been diverted to an area of the garden that did inadvertently flood the neighbor's backyard. So a 16-inch pipe was installed to divert that water all to an unused area of the Arboretum up close to Oleander Drive. That gave it time to filter in through the soil and then also connected it to a little bit of a swale that ran to a creek nearby, which was a good solution, but we saw it as an opportunity to actually educate potential developers or commercial business owners that wanted to do something with their water that might be a problem at their property. So we partnered with Coastal Federation and have a grant. We're going to break ground in May and actually construct an infiltration zone and then a bioretention area. And those are going to be methods that are engineered to actually address the stormwater issue but help it filter back down to our aquifer and be cleaned in the process and not cause a flooding problem any further.
You're listening to Coastline. We've got the new director of North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum, and he's answering your tree landscaping, stormwater runoff questions today. You can email us on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your own question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Tree canopies raise property values. They provide protection from storms and can help mitigate heat islands in urban areas. We're hearing from Lloyd Singleton today. He's the new director of North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. He took over the job just 10 days before Hurricane Florence dropped herself on the region. And he comes from Florida, which deals with many of the same issues the Cape Fear region is coping with, including more flooding, stormwater runoff, heat waves, storm damage. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left for you to get your question or comment in. And Lloyd, just before we went to break, you were talking about collaborating with the Coastal Federation and getting a grant to create this infiltration and bioretention zone at the Arboretum.
Right.
So what is an infiltration zone?
Well, basically, it's going to be a trench that's filled with a lot of rock that will help the water infiltrate more quickly. It has to be installed in an area that has sandy soils, and we happen to have a good zone of sandy soil there. And so that will take the vast majority of the water to prevent it from running off or backing up and flooding. Then there will be a mechanism at the end of it so that if the zone for the infiltration can't handle it, it will pass back up on top and we'll have plenty of time and we'll have plants that are appropriate to take some of the wet conditions occasionally. I think we're going to see that in the future, a lot more need for plants who will tolerate wet conditions. And so we're kind of looking forward to trying some things and seeing what works well.
Is that the bioretention piece?
Yes.
So what are some of the plants that you think will tolerate those conditions?
Well, it's going to be a number of grasses, almost like marsh grasses that we think will do well, and then some wildflowers. We're going to kind of make it a meadow. It's going to look very much like a natural meadow would have in the wetland areas here.
And you think that this is important because we're going to see more soggy land?
I do. I mean, I think the rainfall last year was extraordinary, over 100 inches. And I think we need to be prepared for that kind of thing. And knowing that I think our soils have stayed saturated now for months. And we need to be prepared for that with the appropriate plant species. So,
Yvonne called in during the pledge drive. She says, thank you for promoting trees in our area. Enjoying the show. And you, Lloyd.
Okay.
Travis wrote in, and he says, what kinds of plants would you suggest for a small gardener on a limited budget that is healthy for our environment?
Well, I think you can do a lot in container gardens, particularly in small areas. And that would be where you have large pots that you get to reuse each season. And you could grow, I think many herb species would actually be very useful both for the human growing them and our wildlife. But I think basils and mints and some of those culinary herbs would be easy to grow on a small budget for a small space, but in a container would be ideal.
What do you think? There's been some debate around here about palm trees, and I guess there are different kinds of palms
Yes.
that are more and less appropriate for the region. And we've certainly seen in parts of Brunswick County where developers install these palm trees that look like they're from Florida or the Caribbean, and they sometimes make it through the winter and sometimes don't. What's the general wisdom on that?
All right, so we're Zone 8, and there are a few, just a handful of species of palms that will actually take that potential low temperature. And I'll be frank with you, it's not the fact it gets below freezing, it's the fact that occasionally it stays below freezing for an extended period of time, such as 4 hours. If it just dips to 30 degrees and pops right back up in the morning, it's probably not a problem for many of the palm species that we have seen. But I know a little over a year ago you had, gosh, I think 9 days of sub-zero or sub-freezing temperatures, and that's when we lost a lot of pindo palms. The sable palm is still going to tolerate those conditions, and I think you'll continue to see sables in the area. Tracheocarpus, windmill palm, is a good species that will tolerate even colder conditions than we have. I've seen one in Switzerland. So there are some good palms that can be used. I want to remind our listeners that palms are not trees. They're really more like big pieces of grass. They're monocots, not dicots. But we could leave that discussion for another day.
Well, let's not unpack that. What is a monocot versus a dicot?
Okay, a single growing point. Think of corn or a grass. A palm is going to have a growth habit much more like that. And so it's the very tip, the top of the palm tree that is the growing point, and that is what needs to be protected from a freeze. Whereas if you have a tree, you're going to have the root zone and you're going to have the base of the tree. The biggest difference is that the palm does not get larger in diameter as it grows. As it emerges out of the ground, it's going to be the same diameter that it will always be. It will grow taller, but it doesn't get bigger around. So it just has a different growth habit, and you would treat it very differently.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of good tree management practices, sustainable landscaping, and dealing with issues familiar to the Cape Fear region, especially during hurricane season. Answering your questions on this Wednesday, Lloyd Singleton. He's director of North Carolina Cooperative Extension, New Hanover County Center at the Arboretum. The phones are in service of the pledge drive today, but you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. You've also talked about, with our producer, getting local produce to vacationers, to people who are renting beach houses here.
Yes.
That was, I thought, the craziest, coolest idea. Where did this come from, and why do you think this is important? What will this do for the region?
Okay, well, it was piloted last year in Brunswick County for residents of the Oak Island, and it's an NC State of farm-to-table kind of initiative. And our goal is to work with renters in the Wrightsville Beach area and actually provide them the service to get good fresh produce from our local farmers. I'm partnering with the Wilmington Farmers Market at Tidal Creek, and they will be the suppliers. And the main reason for doing this is to help our local farmers have better sales and really be able to get those highly nutritious fresh products in the hands of our vacationers.
So at this point, do local farmers have a hard time selling all of their product?
I think the more they sell, the more they'll grow. So I want to do everything I can to support local farming, and I think this is one outreach we can do that could just develop into a really good premium service for our vacationers, which then supports our entire county's economic development.
So it sounds a little bit like a CSA. I guess you're not buying for the season, but you're
buying for 1 week. Mm-hmm. It's exactly modeled after a CSA, but we're calling it vacationer-supported agriculture. So VSA, right.
Fair enough. Now, you also are interested in finding ways of getting local produce from local farmers to people who aren't so privileged and won't be renting beach houses, but perhaps who live in food deserts.
Right.
Talk to us about
that. So a program we're also initiating at two farmers markets locally, the one in Poplar Grove and then also the Wilmington Farmers Market at Tidal Creek, is called Donation Station. And we will actually have Master Food volunteers staffing those stations to where people that buy fresh produce are able to donate fresh produce that they purchase to go to local food banks, or they can give money, and then the volunteers will go buy the produce from the farmer before they leave for the day. So the benefit there is the farmer doesn't have to discount their price to do good and to get these highly nutritious products who are underserved, but yet people will be allowed to donate. And food banks are well equipped with non-perishable food, but it's the perishable stuff that we want to get into the hands of those that need it.
And it seems like there could be a logistical issue in terms of shelf life.
Right. And so the fact we have dedicated volunteers doing this and we have the food banks know to expect it by Saturday afternoon, we think it will be very effective.
There's another program that you've talked about starting that would teach at-risk teenagers arboriculture, how to good tree management practices. First of all, tell us why you think that could make a difference in a teenager's life.
Well, if you give a young person a job skill and a lot of confidence in knowing how to do something and lots of attention and help them get a job, I think they're much more likely to succeed in life and be less of a burden on our criminal justice system. I have some experience with a program I developed in Florida where for 8 years now we have trained inmates of the Lowe facility of the Coleman Correctional Center. And we've graduated over 600 inmates in the FNGLA, which is a Florida certified hort professional program. And of those that have been released, we have never seen more than 10% recidivate. So in other words, we're keeping recidivism rate about one-tenth of what it would be on the national average. So we have a 6% recidivism rate among our graduates that have gotten jobs in landscape or horticulture. So we do think it makes a difference. I want to target 16 and 17-year-olds and do a class with 10 or 15 of them this fall, and I think we can add value to our community with their services.
You're listening to Coastline. So the people in Florida, those inmates, were they adults or were they teenagers?
They're adults.
So you've tested this with adults who, one could argue, have a longer pattern of being on a certain trajectory. And so you want to get involved now with at-risk 16 and 17-year-olds.
I do. The ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, but as of December 1st, those that have been 16 and 17 will no longer be adjudicated adults. And so it's expected there will be 190 or so new youth come into the juvenile justice system at age 16 or 17 over the next several months. And we want to be able to provide them an opportunity to get a good job skill. And I also think there's not enough well-trained arborists in this area. And so we really want to change that so we can focus on good tree maintenance.
Okay, I realize that you're an agroecologist.
Mm-hmm.
Define that for us.
It's basically finding the balance between the environment, economics, and the social need. So we can do things in farming, in food production, in even ornamental horticulture that keep all of those in balance. I think we've often focused on only what's good for us as humans, but it's very important that we also help it make money, be a sustainable operation, but then keep the environment in mind.
So what you're saying is being a tree hugger, quite literally, can actually be an economic boon.
Yes.
To a region, like business and development and environmental sustainability. Those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive.
No, they shouldn't be. They should work together for benefit.
So going back to private property and looking at stormwater runoff, are there things that individual property owners can do to help mitigate stormwater runoff?
Absolutely. If someone has a gutter from their roof directed toward their driveway, then that goes directly across the driveway and picks up all the pollutants, the oils and the grease that have come off the cars, and goes right into the storm drain. If they would divert that into a landscaped area of their yard, or even construct a rain garden, an area that's made to accept additional water, then that will filter the water as it goes and goes down to our groundwater.
Sort of like the bioretention area.
Yeah, but on a very small scale. Very easy to do. In fact, there's even grant funding available depending on the watershed that you're in.
For individual property owners?
Yes, through the Soil and Water Conservation District.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll have to post links to those resources.
We'll get
on
that
our
for you.
Website.
Sure.
That's great. What other, I know you're taking a look, a kind of holistic look around the region, and you've said that you would be available to help shape policy when it comes to codes, if necessary.
I'd love to.
What are some of the other changes that you'd like to see happen around the region?
I think mostly an awareness of the trees. I want people to stop taking them for granted or to be afraid of them. And let's actually develop a system where we look at them for their value and we maintain them appropriately so they're not hazardous, they're not risks to us, they're benefits. That's one big change.
And what are some other things that you kind of observe around the region that you think, if leadership just really understood this and we could change that, it would make such a difference?
Well, I do think the development needs to be a little bit more conscious of what they are doing regarding just clear cutting. I think there's a lot of benefit to be gained from stopping and having a little better plan that will take existing tree cover into consideration.
Well, let me just challenge you on that for a moment. We have a minute or so left, but if I'm a developer, it's so much easier to just take out the trees there, and then I'll replant, and I'll replant with newer trees that maybe are prettier and need less maintenance. You're just giving me a blank stare right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I haven't seen that happen. I see people do plantings that may meet code, but it doesn't necessarily take an ecosystem into consideration. And I think there is an opportunity to design new plantings that do have that kind of ecosystem function. But I don't know that that happens frequently.
Is there a place where people can go? I mean, you've mentioned the Master Gardeners at the Arboretum. Mm-hmm. But is there a place where people can go and say, okay, that's an example of a sustainable landscaping design, either commercially or for private property in this region?
Yes, there probably are. I don't know that I have happened upon any yet. Sorry.
That's okay.
I've heard good things about the offices of the Coastal Federation, and I think that might be a great example. I haven't seen it myself, though.
And if there was one thing that you could leave our listeners with in the minute that we have left, if they could make one individual change on their own properties, what's the one thing you'd like to see them do?
Go outside and enjoy nature and take a look at your trees and see what kind of work they need.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Lloyd Singleton, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.